you. Thank you, Ellie. And my distinguished colleagues, I join you with happiness and glee, and I'm happy to be here with you. Can you hear me, or do I need this?
I think the mic would be good.
Okay.
It should be already on.
Hello? No.
I switched it off, sorry.
It's the button switch, just push it on.
Hello?
Yeah, that's good.
Oh, where it's on?
Yes.
Now I have to hold it, right?
No, he doesn't.
It's like an ice cream cone.
First of all, a little bit of self-promotion, because choral conductors are good at that. I like to introduce myself by saying that I've been conductor of Cecilia. I'm the conductor of Cecilia, but I'm not the founding conductor of Cecilia. And I need to tell you that a week from today, at just about this time, Cecilia has organized a benefit concert for the Japan earthquake and tsunami victims. There will be a Trinity Church, and it will consist of, it's a foray program, the Cantique de Jean Racine and the Requiem. And Barbara Bruns, my longtime associate, is going to play Bach's last chorale, then Wir Nöten Höchstens Sein, which is the last piece that Bach wrote, which he had to actually dictate the notes for, so I've been told. And that will start at 3 o'clock, and all the proceeds go to Japan. Everything has been donated. The Boston Musicians Association has allowed us to recruit orchestra without paying them. That's revolutionary in itself. and we have members from choruses from all over. So it's going to be a special event. The soloists are Jessica Cooper and Bob Honeysucker. So now I'm supposed to talk about the history of choruses in New England. First of all, people have sung forever. And we know they were singing. Some of you in this room will know more about some of the subjects I'm going to bring up than I do, because maybe you've preceded me by a few years. Mm-hmm. But in New England, at the very earliest stages, there was some kind of group singing going on, psalm singing. From what I read and study about it, probably the people who sing it are not people you would really aspire to have in your chorus today, because I think it was more rough and tumble kind of singing. In the 19th century, choral music blossomed all over, I won't say all over the world, but all over Europe and America. Very, very large choruses were formed. Sometimes 1,000 people, sometimes more than 1,000 people, singing Handel. Handel? But it was all good, because they were exposing, in Boston, audiences were being exposed to music they didn't know. Antique composers, so-called, Bach and Handel, for instance, who were antique. B.J. Lang, the founder of Boston Cecilia, premiered hundreds, literally hundreds of work of his time. But works of the late 19th century, of course, were more easily digested by the ear than contemporary works today. So he was giving the public what the public was eager to hear. New music by composers, many of whom they knew because they were Boston or New England. In the 19th century, so there were two significant choral establishments in Boston. Handel and Haydn from 1815 and Cecilia from 1876. Incidentally, I have here this beautifully bound volume of all the programs for the first 7 seasons of Boston Cecilia, 1877 to 1883. It's beautifully bound, and actually I'm going to circulate, I only made one copy of this, but perhaps you could just pass it around. Just to see an example, and that's printed at size. They have these tiny little programs with lots of information. People must have had very good eyesight. it's kind of fascinating to go through that book. B.J. Lang, the founder, loved Schumann, so I think the first 2 or 3 seasons saw the pairing. What is it? The Paradise and the Pairing. Yeah. And scenes from Faust, and other works. Some of the programs were composites, lots of little bits and pieces here and there, May songs by various people, and some by composers of the period whom no one would recognize now. And so Handel was the big guy in town. They often sang with 500 or more singers. Cecilia was the small chorus with about 250 in the 19th century. As the 20th century unfolded, things changed. And I'm sorry to say, I think both groups kind of in the first half of the 20th century fell into a bit of a slump. Leadership, administrative leadership, was probably not as aggressive as it should have been. And the musicians, the singers, were allowed to grow older and older and older. And which is, there's nothing wrong with growing older, but this instrument tends to tire after a while. And unlike conductors, who never. But the whole situation changed with World War II. After the war, we had this surge of people coming into Boston, men primarily, coming into Boston who had to defer their education for three, four, five, 6 years in some cases. So the city was filled, the schools were filled to overflowing with not 18-year-old, 20-year-old men, but men who were 24, 25, 26. And those were mature voices, unlike most collegiate voices then and now. So there was an impetus to use these men, and there have always been fine women singers around. And Bud Patterson took advantage of that. He formed the Chorus for Musica, as we were told, in 1948 or 49. I think he was organist at Christ Church in Cambridge when that group was organized. And it was absolutely unique and remained unique in many respects throughout his tenure. Bud was extremely musical, and he was wonderful at teaching music. He could be a little crazy. I remember a performance of when I was working for him, I remember a performance of the Matthew Passion, which we did in Symphony Hall, and we came to a stopping point in the program, just a brief break, and I turned to the cellist, who I think was Corinne Flavin, and I said, "Have we ever seen this next movement before?" And she said, "I haven't." So sometimes we would go into the concerts, and you people who were members of the CPM will appreciate and actually treasure some of those high wire acts that you accomplished by being part of Bud's original group. And they were very exciting times. I came with Bud, was hired by him in 63 or 64, and worked with him for 3 or 4 years until I went to work with Adam Hayden when Tom Dunn came to Boston. But they were very exciting years with Bud. I'll tell you one little anecdote about a concert that's more embarrassing for me than for anybody else. We were doing a concert at Kresge Auditorium at MIT, and the organ, if you've been there, you know the organ is exposed way up there on the right-hand side. We had a rehearsal on the day of the performance. Everything was all set, and I was a little nervous about being so exposed, so when I left the organ, I had every stop pulled, everything was all set, so when it came time to come out, I could just put my fingers down on the keys and hit sound. Well, the chorus came on, the conductor came on, I sat down at the organ, and he gave one of Bud's great downbeats, and I put my keys on the organ, and nothing happened. Somebody had turned it off. And the switch was out in the hall. So that's a story.
Right. Scary one.
It still makes my face flush. And at the same time that Bud was founding CPM, the college choruses became much more serious too. Harvard Radcliffe and the conservatory. The conservatory under Lorna Cook DeVarin. Lorna Cook DeVarin was a musician of wonderful musicianship and wonderful taste. And her strongest quality, it seems to me, was she had a will of iron. She knew how to work the politics of the conservatory. And if you ever had any contact with the conservatory, you know you have to be very clever in order to work your way. Conservatory has always been negligent of the chorus. Is the president of the conservatory? I wish she were. I do still teach there, so I have to be discreet. But Cookie came in and established a standard of musicianship and of excitement of programming and a relationship with the Boston Symphony, which was incredibly valuable to both the conservatory's reputation, the entire reputation of the conservatory. Harvard Radcliffe also shared that affiliation with occasional performances with the BSO under Münch, and of course CPM. So there was no Tanglewood First Festival chorus, so the conductor always had to, I suppose it was a delicate balance of which chorus do you pick for which piece.
I remember Romeo and Juliet in Berlioz, one of the most exciting, when the weekend they announced his retirement. That was kind of an exciting time. Helen Haydn and Cecilia had fallen into a decline, serious decline in those years. But what has happened because of CPM and because of the rise of the quality of the conservatory and the Harvard Radcliffe is that other schools in the area have taken choral music seriously, other colleges, and community choruses have risen in quality very much. There was the Framingham Choral Society has been in existence for a long time, Dedham Choral Society. Brian Jones conducted the Dedham Choral Society for a long time. And I think all of these, these groups all profited from a general increase in awareness and excitement about choral music. The situation has always been, for the last 30 or 40 years, has always been there are more qualified singers than there are audiences to hear them. But that's another issue. Now we have wonderful specialized groups, that are early music groups. I wish there were groups that specialized only in contemporary music, because I think there are singers who could staff a kind of group, a small group. And I wish there were more groups who explored the Renaissance, and there's room for more groups of that sort too. There's also room for groups that do a general repertoire. The repertoire has changed because those kinds of programs that you'll see in that program passing around the B.J. Langdon in the 19th century would probably not be acceptable today. Critically, they would come under some fire. But things have changed, and they're going to continue to change, and we're going to talk about that later. If I've gone on too long.
Oh, no.
I apologize.
That's good. You took up a lot of my time, which I don't.
We should get 9 minutes.
Thank you so much, John. Let's